blush when a cloth covering their shame comes loose, when the Lord of lives lives drowned without a face in the world, how can you be modest? When all the world is the eye of the Lord, on looking everywhere, what can you cover and conceal? Devotees of this kind may be in this world, but not of it. The power and passion with which they lived their lives make them inspirations for generations of humanity. Akka continues to be a living presence in the Indian collective consciousness. Her lyrical poems remain among the most prized works of South Indian literature to this very day. Embracing mystery. It is only a juvenile intelligence that analyzes things and arrives at a conclusion. If your intelligence is sufficiently evolved and mature, you realize that the more you analyze, the further away you are from any conclusion. If you go deeply into any aspect of life, you will move further and further away from any conclusion. Life becomes more mysterious than ever before. The more you delve into life, you see that it is an endless, unfathomable process. You cannot get it because you are it. When you realize experientially that every atom, every grain of sand, every pebble, every piece of life from the smallest to the biggest is unfathomable, you will naturally bow down in utmost devotion to everything. If you simply sit here and breathe, you will know life better than through any deep analysis. As we dissect everything, wanting to excavate truth from physical nature, we enter into the minute dimensions of particle science. From protons, neutrons, and electrons to neutrinos, bosons, and supersymmetric particles, we seem to be going deeper and deeper, but all this is still only in the realm of physical nature. Dark matter, we are told, comprises more of the universe than matter. This dark matter is not composed of atoms at all, but of particles of still unknown type. Pick up a glass of water and take a look at it. What do you really know about it? Why, for instance, do hydrogen and oxygen combine to become water? Or pick up a pebble and gaze at it long and hard. Why does it have this particular shape, size, grain, texture? Or just look at yourself. Why are you the way you are? Many would reply, "Oh, my father, my mother, and here I am." But why are you like this? What is the basis of this form, this body, this individuality? Traditionally in India, it was said that one ought to bow down to everything that one encounters. It did not matter if it was a tree or a cow or a snake or a cloud, you just bow down to it. When you bow down to everything, it could be because you are a fool or because you have looked at life in its utmost profundity. The difference between an idiot and an enlightened being is thin. The two often look similar, but they are actually worlds apart. An idiot is incapable of drawing conclusions. A mystic is unwilling to draw conclusions. The rest have glorified their conclusions as knowledge. The fool just enjoys whatever little he knows. The one who has seen life in its utmost depth enjoys it absolutely. The rest are the ones who constantly struggle and suffer. One morning, a man walked into his office and told his boss, "Boss, I want you to know, 3 big companies are after me. You must give me a raise." His boss said, "What? Which companies? Who wants you?" He said, "The electric company, the telephone company, and the gas company." Something is always behind the so-called smart people, those with confirmed conclusions about life. Or else, they are always busy chasing something. An idiot can sit here quietly. A mystic can sit here quietly. The rest cannot. Devotion is a simple method of dissolving all the hurdles on the path. If those who are struggling to contain the chattering of the monkey mind become devoted, the chatter will just evaporate. If you learn to bow, to hold everything higher than yourself, it does not seem to be good for your self-esteem, but becoming a devotee does not mean you are a pushover. That which knows how to bend will not break. That is so with everything within you. Unfortunately, these days, even so-called spiritual leaders are talking about self-esteem. Self and esteem are both a problem. Both are very limited entities. Both are fragile. Both will always be insecure. If you have no esteem, very good. If you have no self, fabulous. Sadhana. When you experience something as far bigger than yourself, bowing down will naturally occur to you. If you want to become a devotee, at least once an hour in all the waking moments of your life, put your hands together and bow to something. It does not matter who or what. Don't choose. Whatever you see, just bow your head. Whether it is a tree, a mountain, a dog, a cat, or anything. This need not be a physical act. It could be internal action. Just do it throughout the day, once an hour. See if it can become once a minute. When it becomes once a minute, there is no need to use your hands and body. Simply do it within yourself. Once that becomes your way of being, you are a devotee. Even if you spend a lifetime, you still will not understand a leaf, an elephant, an ant, or an atom. You are incapable of figuring out even a molecule of DNA. Everything you cannot grasp is in a higher state of existential intelligence than you are. When you see this, really see this, you are a devotee. A devotee is someone who is willing to dissolve into the object of devotion. If you are a devotee of life, you will become one with it. Don't be an outsider to the life process. Become a devotee. Dissolve.
Energy. Following the pranic trail. At present, human beings identify with the body and the mind in a variety of ways. But fundamentally, what you call myself is just a certain amount of energy. Modern science has proved beyond all doubt that all of existence is made of the same energy, manifesting itself in millions of bewilderingly different ways. When Einstein gives us the formula E equals mc squared, he is, to put it simply, saying that everything in the universe can be seen as just one energy. Religions all over the world have been proclaiming the same thing using somewhat different terminology when they assert God is everywhere. Modern science has arrived at its conclusions through mathematical deduction. Religion has arrived at its conclusions through belief. But the yogi is a hard nut who will not settle for deduction or belief. he or she seeks to experience the ultimate through the enhancement of individual perception. Consequently, the yogic tradition does not mention God or deny it either. The human longing to expand is actually just an expression of the ultimate formless intelligence that is the very source of who we are. Instead of trying to find the source of our longing, we try to give it expression in the outside world. Due to the nature of our outward-bound senses, we are deceived into believing that outward expression will somehow bring fulfillment. When you misinterpret the expression as the cause, it will only bring entanglement, not freedom. The sole aim of every individual's life energies is to touch the infinite, the very core of our making. They know no other aim. Your mind may be thinking of money or a new house. Your body may be longing for food or sleep, but your life energies are always longing to break the boundaries set by your physical and mental structures. Slowly in the process of living, many people have stopped following the trajectory of their life energies. The result is that they start believing that they are separate or autonomous entities. But separateness is a myth. The content of both your physical and mental bodies has been gathered from the outside. They belong to you, but they are not you. If you want to go the way your body is going currently, you should know that it is going straight to the grave. Similarly, whatever you know as the mind is a complex mess of all the stuff that has been accumulating. The objectives of the mind are entirely self-created. They may seem to be fine right now, but they usually take you completely away from the process of life. So if you go the way your mind goes, you should know you are heading towards an alternative psychological creation. It may be fascinating, stimulating, or even comforting for a length of time, but it bears no relation at all to existential reality. The entire yogic process is aimed at aligning oneself with the natural longing of life to expand in an unlimited way. It gives conscious expression to this basic human need. The various spiritual practices in the yogic sciences are intended to assist this longing on three levels: the physical body, the mental body, and the third sheath or layer of human mechanism, the pranamaya kosha, or the energy body. Yoga means to experience the mental and physical processes distinctly, not as the basis of yourself, but as that which is caused by you. If you manage these two instruments of body and mind consciously, then your experience of life is 100% of your making. All you need to do is create a distance between you and everything that you have accumulated from outside. Everything that you have gathered in this life accompanies you wherever you go. It is deeply attached to you. You in turn are deeply attached to it on some unconscious level. It becomes an encumbrance because you don't know when to put it down and when to pick it up. It is like a sack you carry on your shoulders all the time. But it is possible for you to put it down. It will still be your companion, but at least it won't be that burdensome. It is definitely possible to create some distance between you and what you have gathered. You can use it when you want, but you need not be identified with it. If you cannot maintain this distance, your whole vision of life will be clouded. Your memory and your imagination, which includes all your ideas, beliefs, and emotions, belong to the psychological realm. Life can be tasted and transcended only when there is a distinction between the psychological and the existential. The spiritual process means a return to life. It means following the deep intelligence of your life energies. There are many ways of recognizing which way your life energies want to go. If you disidentify with the psychological and physiological processes, you will clearly see this. It is only when you consciously head in the direction of your life energies that you find equanimity and harmony. It is only in such a stable state that you would dare to explore the highest levels of exuberance and venture into the deepest mysteries of life. Pain, not suffering. In my motorcycle days, I used to ride all over the country. One day when I was in a remote area, a freak accident occurred, and my calf muscle was slashed right up to the bone. So I went to a local clinic, asked the doctor to fix my leg. The doctor examined the wound and said there was no way he could, because he had no anesthetic facility. He suggested that I rush to a bigger hospital and seek immediate medical attention. I said I didn't have the time, that I had to continue my journey because I had a schedule to meet. I told him he had to fix it. He refused. I was bleeding profusely. After much argument, he gave in because a pool of blood was gathering where I stood. So without any anesthesia, he began to put my muscle together, which took about 52 sutures on 3 different levels. Through this entire process, I was having a conversation with him. He was sweating and puffing through it all. After it was over, he asked me incredulously, "Is there no pain in your leg at all?" There was pain, terrible, unbearable pain. But pain is a natural phenomenon. And it is good. Without it, you wouldn't know if your leg was chopped off, but suffering is another matter altogether. Pain is bad enough. Why make it worse with suffering? Suffering is entirely self-created, and every human being has the choice to suffer or not to suffer. It doesn't take much intelligence to choose the latter. The karmic conundrum. Once it happened, on a certain day, Shankaran Pillai was sitting in a bar with his buddies. Suddenly the clock struck 8. Shankaran Pillai put down his glass, rose, and started walking toward the door. His friend said, "Hey, what's the problem? Where are you going? Why don't you finish your drink?" But Shankaran Pillai kept walking wordlessly, zombie-like, towards the door. The friends laughed and said, "Okay, now we know. It's 8 o'clock. You got to go home. You're afraid of your wife, aren't you? What are you, a man or a mouse?" Shankaran Pillai stopped, turned around, and said, "I am the man in the house. If I were a mouse, my wife would be afraid of me." He walked slowly home. His wife's rule was that he should reach home by 8. Today, the man-mouse argument and his slow, inebriated pace had delayed him. His wife was sitting on the porch, rolling pin in hand. She glowered at him and said, "You fool, once again drinking? Come here, I will show you." Shankaran Pillai was a frail but agile man. He walked toward her meekly, but then suddenly leapt over her and ran into the house. She rose and lumbered after him. He made her run all over the house, confident that she would never be able to catch him. After much running around, he darted into the bedroom and scampered and hid under the bed. She rushed behind him. She was a big woman, could not slip under the bed. He lay there, secure, as she hollered, "You coward, what are you doing under the bed? Come out. Are you a man or a mouse?" Shankaran Pillai replied, I am the man of this house. I have the freedom to lie down wherever I want. It was the only place he could be at that moment, but he needed to claim it was his freedom. Unfortunately, most human beings are doing much the same thing. They are labeling their compulsions, their limitations, as their choices. If you can joyfully do whatever is needed in a given situation, this is freedom. But limiting yourself to doing only what you like is a horribly compulsive way to live. This compulsiveness is the trick of karma, that ancient word that has been mangled by popular usage across the world. What exactly is karma? Karma literally means action. Action is of three kinds. It would be in terms of body, mind, or energy. Whatever you do with your body, mind, or energy leaves a certain residue. This residue forms a pattern of its own, and these resultant patterns stay with you. When you gather a huge volume of impressions, slowly these shape themselves into tendencies, and you become like an automatic toy, a slave to your patterns, a puppet of your past. Karma is like old software that you have written for yourself. Unconsciously, depending on the type of actions that you perform, you write your software. Once you write a certain type of software, your whole system functions accordingly. Based on the information from the past, certain memory patterns are formed and keep recurring. Now life is just cyclical. This is why the same patterns keep returning in your life. There are a few variations, but they remain essentially the same, repeating themselves across generations. After a while, this repetitiveness can be deadly. It is important to see that these patterns rule you from within, not from without. No one has to exercise any external control upon you. Your inner autocrat rules you all the time. You may think it is a new day. Circumstances may change, but internally you are experiencing the same thing over and over again. And so, the more things change, the more they stay the same, not physically, but experientially. You are helplessly stuck in the karmic rut. Freedom is now an empty word, because the way you think, feel, and understand life, even the way you sit, stand, and move, is conditioned by your past impressions. From the moment you were born, your parents, your family, your education, your friends, where you lived, where you traveled, all this decided everything about you. Karma is encrypted on every aspect of life. It is imprinted on your mental memory, the fundamentals of your body, your chemistry, your very energy. These are all backup systems. Even if you lose your body or your mind, you still do not lose your karma. The backup systems are so efficient. What you consider to be your personality, the bundle of traits and tendencies that you are, is because of information you have gathered unconsciously. These tendencies have been traditionally described as vasanas. The word vasana literally means smell. Depending upon what type of garbage is in the bin today, that is the kind of smell that will emanate from it. Depending upon what type of smell you emit, you attract certain kinds of life situations to yourself. Suppose today there is rotten fish in the garbage bin. It may stink for you, but many other creatures are drawn to it. Tomorrow, if there are flowers in the garbage bin, it smells different and still other creatures are drawn to it. When I first went down south to the city of Coimbatore almost 30 years ago, I stayed as a guest in a physician's house. He was a gregarious man and told me of an incident that happened in his family. They were from a coastal region in India, and his elder daughter was particularly fond of fish. She was studying up north in the hills of Dehradun, where she did not get fish to eat. So whenever she came home for her vacation, she wanted to have it every day. His wife was a vegetarian, but she would cook fish even though she did not eat it. There is a particular variety of small dried fish that you would know if you are from that part of the country. It has an incredible odor. If it is being carried in a truck, you would like to drive 2 miles behind the truck or hold your breath as you pass it. Cooking it in the house is a pretty good strategy to evict your neighbors from their homes. This girl wanted that particular fish to be prepared. So as they were frying this dried fish, and it was as if the entire house was being fumigated, such an odor could raise the dead. The mother went into the kitchen to tell the cooks how to prepare it, but the moment the stink began to emanate from the frying pan, she ran out of the kitchen because she could not stand it. Meanwhile, the girl who was in the bedroom also smelled it and ran out, following the scent. Both the mother and the daughter crashed headlong into each other, and the mother ended up with a broken nose. I mention this incident not as an illustration of reward and punishment, but as an illustration of the possible consequences of strong attachment and aversion. When these dominate your life, some kind of smash-up is inevitable. Vasanas, or tendencies, are generated by a vast accumulation of impressions caused by your physical, mental, and energy actions. What you call your personality is just an expression of these tendencies. Now, today, if you are doing something in a particular way, and someone asks you why you can't do it differently, you often declare, "This is my nature. Can't I do what I want?" This is not your nature. You are not doing what you want. These tendencies have become compulsive. This is your bondage, a kind of software you are writing for yourself unconsciously. Once your software is fixed, it looks as if there is only one path you can walk in your life. It looks as if your destiny is predetermined, a spiritual process, however, means we have made up our minds to rewrite our software consciously. In India, karma is a common word. If people exhibit any kind of compulsive behavior, others will immediately say, "Oh, that's their karma." This means that it is of their making. The bitterness or sweetness of any experience is not in the event itself, but in how you perceive and respond to it. What is a very bitter experience for one person could be a blessing for another. Once a grief-stricken man sat by a gravestone crying bitterly and hitting his head against it, "My life, oh, how senseless it is! My body is a worthless carcass now that you have gone. If only you had lived, if only fate had not been so cruel, if only you hadn't left, how different my life would have been." A clergyman nearby overheard him and said, "I assume the person lying beneath this mound of earth was someone of great importance to you." "Importance? Yes, indeed," wept the man, wailing even louder. "It was my wife's first husband." So the quality of your life is always decided by how you experience life, not by what life offers you. It is important to remember that karma is not a negative word. Karma is what gives stability and structure to your life. Every moment, impressions are flooding in torrents into your system through your 5 sense organs, and each of them is being recorded. There is nothing wrong with this stored information. It is very useful for your survival. If you deleted all of it, you would not know how to handle even the simplest aspects of life. The spiritual process does not seek to demolish the storehouse of karmic impressions, but helps you to become more conscious of it and establish a little space which allows you to stand outside of it. So your software is not in itself the problem. It turns into a problem only if it becomes the ruling factor in your life. To talk of good karma and bad karma is like talking of good bondage and bad bondage. There is no such thing. Karma is just your own creation. It is neither good nor bad. It is software that can be useful if you have some freedom from it. This is all the spiritual process aims to do, loosen the grip of karma upon you. Whatever be the nature of your past karma, there is enough awareness in a human being to take complete charge of the karma of the present moment. If you want any kind of transformation, any kind of forward movement in your life, it can only happen if you break the cyclical patterns of karma. Anything that is cyclical suggests constant motion, but it doesn't really go anywhere. If you are sensitive to life, you realize this early. If you are less sensitive, you realize this as you grow older. Everything may seem to be going your way. Your professional life may be flourishing, your capital may be increasing, your family may be thriving, but you are not really getting anywhere. The faster you achieve your success, the faster you realize this. When you are in a certain state of insufficiency, you keep thinking that everything will be okay once your dreams are realized. But if all the things that you dreamt of happen very quickly, you suddenly realize that, although everything is happening as you thought it should, life still remains unfulfilled and your longings persist. Until you break this cycle, there is no real choice in your life. Sometimes you may have felt you have experienced a breakthrough. Things seem to have changed, and everything seems great for the next 3 days. But on the fourth day, you fall back into the same rut. Hasn't this happened to you any number of times? That is because there is no freedom of thought, emotion, action, and above all, no freedom of experience as long as you're in the karmic grip. At the same time, avoiding karma is not the answer either. Avoidance may give you some balance and stability in day-to-day life, but slowly it saps you of life and joy. This is very negative karma in itself. Denying, suppressing, and avoiding life brings more bondage than freedom. The desire, "I don't want karma," is itself a big karma. The very process of living is itself a dissolution of karma. If you live every moment of your life totally, you dissolve enormous amounts of karma. When you experience everything that comes your way absolutely, when you experience every life breath with utmost intensity, without the distractions of thought and emotion, devoid of any psychological drama, you are liberated from the very process of birth and death. You are not only more alive, you are life itself. Yoga offers a way to distance yourself not just from your karma, but from the very source of karma, which is the discriminatory intellect. It offers you the choice every moment of your existence to be either a victim or a spectator or the very master of your life. With a certain amount of effort and practice, we can all write a software of joy and well-being for ourselves. Sadhana. When you realize that all your material achievements are of value only in comparison with those who do not have them, this is joy that springs from another's deprivation. Can you really call this joy?
isn't it actually a kind of sickness? It is time everyone addressed this. If you were alone on this planet, what would you want for yourself? Ask yourself this question and see where it takes you. Try this. Sit alone for 5 minutes and see what your life would be like if you were absolutely alone in this world. If there were nobody or nothing to compare yourself with, what would you truly long for? What would really matter to you if there were no external appreciation or critique? If you do this every day, you will become aligned with the longings of the life that you are, rather than the accumulated karmic mess that you believe you are.
The mechanics of life. Fundamentally, Kriya means internal action. An internal action is one that does not involve either the body or the mind or the physical dimensions of energy. As we have established earlier, the body and the mind are yours, but still external to you. You have gathered both from the outside. The body is an accumulation of food and the mind an accumulation of impressions. Even the imprints upon the energy body are an accumulation of the impressions of the 5 senses. When you have the ability to perform action with the non-physical aspect of your energy, then it is termed a kriya. All this may sound somewhat esoteric, but only if you are inducted by someone who has mastery over the realms of energy will it become possible for you to practice kriya. If your actions find outward expression involving body, mind, and the physical dimensions of energy, this is karma. If you turn inward and perform an action beyond all dimensions of physicality, that is kriya. Karma is the process of binding you. Kriya is the process of liberating you. Most significant aspect of yoga is always to perform action beyond the physical dimensions of energy. Among the 4 dimensions of physicality, you are most conscious of the bodily actions, less of the mental, much less of the emotional, and negligibly of the energetic. The moment you learn to perform action with the non-physical aspect of your life energy, you suddenly move to a new level of freedom within and outside of yourself. How do you access the non-physical aspect of your life energy? The yogic practices, which involve postures, breath, attitudes of mind, and energy activation, are all essentially oriented toward aligning the 3 layers of the body, the physical, the mental, and the energetic body. It is only in aligning them that you find access to dimensions beyond physical, to the fundamental life energy itself. I have seen any number of people who start doing a simple kriya and suddenly become so creative that they are able to achieve things that they never imagined possible in their lives. This is simply because they loosened their karmic foundations a little. They shook up their life energies for a change instead of being entangled with their physical processes of body, mind, and energy. This is something every human being can learn to do. Kriya Yoga is a very powerful way to walk the spiritual path, but at the same time, it is tremendously demanding. For most modern urban people who are unaccustomed to using their body in its full versatility, Kriya Yoga could seem arduous and inhuman. This is because kriyas are elaborate and involve a great deal of discipline, focus, and exactitude. Most people do not have the body, the attitude, or the stability of emotion for this yoga path. Primarily, because they are used to living right from their childhood, in perpetual state of comfort. Being used to a level of physical comfort is not a problem, but being in constant quest of comfort, this is a great problem. That kind of attitude and emotion is unsuitable for the path of Kriya Yoga. Also, Kriya Yoga cannot be done with people who talk freedom all the time. It is not for people who keep asking, "Why am I not free to eat my ice cream? Why can't I wake up whenever I feel like it? Why can't I eat, drink, and have sex with whoever, whenever I feel like?" If you take the path of Kriya, a certain fundamental discipline has to be brought into all physical, psychological, and emotional processes. If you want to hit the peak of your consciousness, this discipline is essential. You cannot be partying till early morning and attempt to scale Mount Everest tomorrow. The same logic holds true here. When you are given a certain Kriya Yoga regimen, you have to follow it. You may understand the need for the discipline as you go along, but it can never be fully explained. And if it has to be explained, the essence of Kriya will be lost. This is because Kriya is a tool to transcend the framework of logic and experience in order to access those non-physical dimensions that are considered spiritual or mystical. If I want to teach you Kriyas just as practices, it would be simple to put them in a book form which you could learn and memorize them. But for the Kriya to be a live process, to be imprinted in your system in a certain way, it needs a certain discipline, dedication, and receptivity. When you walk a completely new terrain, if there is no trust in the one who guides you, then the journey becomes unnecessarily long and difficult. Generally, on the path of Kriya, most gurus make the disciples wait. Traditionally, when students went to a guru to learn Kriya Yoga, they might well have been told to sweep the floor for a year, then wash the dishes for another. If their trust still did not waver, then the guru might consider initiating them into the Kriyas. There is a reason for this. Once you empower people in a particular way that makes their system vibrant beyond normal standards, they can cause great damage to themselves if their attitudes and emotions are not as they should be. But in today's world, to get that kind of time with people, to arrive at that kind of trust, then imprint these Kriyas is difficult. It is not impossible, but the chances are becoming remote. I spent 21 years of my life transforming a powerful Kriya, the Shambhavi Mahamudra, in order that it might be taught to large numbers of people in today's world. Certain aspects that could empower people either to harm themselves or others, or influence the elements around them, have been firewalled, so only the physical, psychological, and spiritual benefits remain. For those 2 decades, I deliberately stayed away from all forms of public outreach, because my entire focus was primarily on recrafting the Kriya to ensure that it could be widely imparted without any adverse effects. Kriya Yoga is a full-fledged path, is important only for those interested in exploring mystical dimensions. If your concern is only well-being, or if you are just seeking realization, Kriyas can be used in a small way. But Kriya Yoga as an exclusive path is not necessary because it requires too much application. If you follow the path of Kriya very intensely without guidance, it may take a few lifetimes to bear fruit. If you have someone to actively guide the process, Kriya can be most powerful and magnificent way to explore the inner nature and mystical phenomena. Otherwise, Kriya is somewhat roundabout route. What you are seeking on this path is not just well-being, blissfulness, or realization. Instead, you want to know the very mechanics of life-making. You want to know the engineering of life. That is why it is a much longer process. People on the Kriya path have a completely different kind of presence about them because of the mastery over their energies. They can dismantle life and put it back together. If you are pursuing the path of jnana, for example, your intellect could become razor sharp, but there is still very little you can do with your energies. Similarly, on the path of bhakti or devotion, there is nothing much you can do with your energies, nor do you care, because the intense sweetness of your emotions is all that matters. You only want to dissolve into the object of your devotion. If you are on the path of karma, you can do many things in the external world, but you can do little with yourself. Kriya yogis, on the other hand, can do whatever they wish with their inner world and achieve a great deal in the outer world as well. Sadhana. The very way the karmic structure works in every human being is essentially cyclical. If you observe very closely, within a day, the same cycles are happening many times over. If you are very observant, you will see that every 40 minutes you are going through a physiological cycle. Once you see that, then with the necessary attention and awareness, you can ride the cycle and move towards transcendence from the limitations that these cycles set. So, every 40 minutes, life presents you with an opportunity, the opportunity to become conscious. Every 40 to 48 minutes, there is also a shift of dominance in the way the breath is moving through the right and left nostrils. It is dominant in the right nostril for a length of time and then in the left. Become aware of this so you know at least something about you is changing. This awareness can be further enhanced into awareness of the solar and lunar influences upon the body. If you bring your physical system in sync with the lunar and solar cycles, your physical and psychological health is guaranteed. The energy labyrinth. The yogic system offers us a comprehensive and elaborate view of the anatomy of the human energy body. It has mapped 72,000 channels, or nadis as they are called, in the energy system. The prana, or energy, moves through these channels. These 72,000 channels spring, in turn, from three basic channels. The channel on the right is known as pingala, the left is known as ida, the central is known as Sushumna. These three channels are the basis of the energy system. Pingala is symbolized as the masculine, ida is symbolized as the feminine. Masculine and feminine do not refer here to biological differences, but to certain qualities in nature that have been identified as such. These qualities are represented by these two channels. If a person's pingala is very pronounced, then the outgoing exploratory qualities will be dominant. If the ida is more pronounced, receptive and reflective qualities will be dominant. Whether one is a man or a woman has nothing to do with this. You may be a man, but the ida may be more dominant. You may be a woman, but the pingala may be more dominant. The pingala and ida are also symbolized as the sun and the moon. The sun representing the masculine, the moon representing the feminine. The sun is aggressive and outgoing. The moon receives and reflects. The cycles of the moon are deeply connected with the female body as well. On the level of your mind, pingala represents the logical dimension,
Ida represents the intuitive dimension. These two dualities are the fundamentals of the physical sphere of life. A human being is complete only when both the masculine and the feminine function at full force and are in proper balance. Sushumna, the central nadi, is the most significant aspect of your physiology, yet it generally goes unexplored. It is independent of the 72,000 nadis, but it is the fulcrum of the whole system. Once the energies enter your Sushumna, irrespective of what is happening around you, you have a certain balance. Right now you may be reasonably balanced, but if the outside situation is challenging, you will also be disturbed. Once energies enter the Sushumna, however, your inner way of being becomes independent of the outside, because it is independent of the 72,000 nadis. There is a great deal of chakra talk nowadays. Chakra means wheel and has a very specific meaning and significance in the yogic system. These days, there are wheel alignment centers that claim to balance your chakras, clear your blocks, and heal your ailments, past, present, and future. Lots of people are doing chakras these days. It has become a huge fad, but it can be dangerous. It is time to approach this very subtle subject with care and precision. The nadis do not have a physical manifestation. If you cut the body and look inside, you will not find them. But as you become more aware, you will notice the energy is not moving at random, but in established pathways. The chakras are powerful centers in the physiology where the nadis meet in a particular way to create an energy vortex. Like the nadis, the chakras are of a subtle nature and do not have a physical existence. They always meet in the form of a triangle, not a circle, as the word chakra suggests. The moving part in a machine is always a circle, because circle is capable of movement with least resistance. These energy centers are so named because the wheel suggests movement or dynamism. There are 114 chakras in the body. Two are outside the body and 112 within the body. Among these 112, there are seven major chakras. For most people, three of these are active. The remaining are either dormant or mildly active. You do not have to activate all the 114 chakras to live a physical life. You can live quite a complete life with just a few of them. If you were active in all the 114 chakras, you would have no sense of body at all. The purpose of yoga is to activate your energy system in such a way that your body consciousness is constantly being lowered. So you can sit here in the body, but you are no longer the body. In southern India, there was a legendary yogi named Sadashiva Brahmendra. He was a Nirkaya, which literally means bodiless yogi. He had no sense of body. Wearing clothes does not even occur to a person in such a state. He just walked around naked. Also, in such a condition, there is no sense of home, property, or physical boundary. One day, he happened to walk into the king's garden on the banks of River Kaveri. The king was sitting there, relaxing with his queens. Sadashiva Brahmendra wandered into the garden, unaware of his own nakedness. The king was furious. "Who is this fool that dares to walk naked in front of my woman?" He sent his soldiers after him. The soldiers ran behind Sadashiva Brahmendra, calling out to him. He did not turn back. He continued to walk. Angered, one of the soldiers took out his sword and struck him, severing his right arm. Sadashiva Brahmendra did not even break his stride. He continued walking. Seeing this, the soldiers were wonderstruck and terrified. They realized that this was no ordinary man. The king and his soldiers ran after him, prostrated,
begged his forgiveness, and brought him back to the garden. He lived in that garden for the rest of his life, and finally shed his body there. There are innumerable instances like this in the yogic tradition. When your energies are in a heightened condition, the sense of the physical is so diminished that it is even possible to go without any external nourishment for days on end. What exactly is the role of chakras within the system? There are seven fundamental chakras. The Muladhara, which is located at the perineum, the space between the anal outlet and the genital organ. Swadhisthana, which is just above the genital organ. Manipuraka, which is 3/4 of an inch below the navel. Anahata, which is just below the sternum. Vishuddhi is at the pit of the throat. Agna, which is between the eyebrows. And Sahasrara, also known as Brahmarandra, which is at the fontanel on top of the head, where the newborn infants have a soft spot. The chakras are the seven different dimensions through which our energies find expression. Experiences that happen within you, anger, misery, peace, joy, and ecstasy, are different levels of expression of your life energies. If your life energies are dormant in Muladhara, then food and sleep will be the most dominant factors in your life. If your energies are dominant in Swadhisthana, pleasure will be most dominant in your life. This means you enjoy the physical reality in many ways. If your energies are dominant in Manipuraka, you are a doer, you can accomplish many things in the world. If your energies are dominant in Anahata, you are a very creative person. If your energies are dominant in the Vishuddhi, you will develop a powerful presence. If your energies are dominant in Agna, then you are intellectually realized. Intellectual realization can bring you to a certain state of peace and stability within yourself, irrespective of what is happening outside of you. These are just different levels of intensity. A pleasure seeker has more intensity to his life than someone whose life is just food and sleep. A man who wants to initiate something in the world has much more intensity than a pleasure seeker. An artist or a creative person lives his life more intensely compared to these three people. If you move into Vishuddhi, it is a completely different dimension of intensity, and Agna is higher still. If you hit your Sahasrara, you will explode into unexplained ecstasies. Without any external stimuli or reason, you are simply ecstatic because your energies have touched a certain peak. It is misleading to speak of lower and higher chakras. It is like comparing the foundation of the building to the roof. The roof is not superior. The foundation is not inferior. The quality, lifespan, stability, and security of a building depends to a large extent more on the foundation than upon the roof. For example, in the physical body, your energies need to be in Muladhara chakra to some extent. Mula means root or source, and Adhara means foundation. In the engineering of the body, this is the base. If you wish to grow, you need to cultivate this. At the same time, chakras have a spiritual dimension, not just a physical one. If you bring the right amount of awareness to it, the same Muladhara can be transformed to a point where you become absolutely free of the compulsive need for food and sleep. The chakras fall into one of the two different dimensions, the Muladhara, Swadhisthana, Manipuraka, and related chakras are more concerned with keeping the body stable and rooted. These are qualities associated with earth, with self-preservation. When your energies are dominant in these chakras, your qualities are earthy and you are more in the grip of nature. The upper chakras, the Vishuddhi, Agna, Sahasrara, and related chakras are centers that draw you away from the pull of the earth. They are concerned with the longing for the infinite. They make you receptive to a force that we customarily refer to as grace. The middle chakra, Anahata, is